window where I watch the future start. My pupils dilated and the shock sped up my arms. I shut my ambushed eyes, turn my face towards the heat. I felt the city choke, I heard the world at war. I prayed for providence, God said don't pray no more. You went and made your mess, keep your blame off my feet. So I got off my knees, I faced the devil's day. The sky was murder red, and the streets were headstone gray. Flaming Ferris wheel spun where the sun used to be, and I watched its buckets dip and dance. Saw a couple making love lock hands. They were pushing for abandon and the answers it could bring. 90 million miles from the graveyard, growing over everything.
I am David Callison, and this is The Sound and the Story. In college, 2004, I had this old canvas messenger bag from high school that was covered in pins and patches, and the way they told everyone, I had not gotten over being in high school. I wrote on it with blue ballpoint pen these words: "It's a daydream I keep having to make the clocks move while I'm working." It was a lyric from Kevin Devine's sophomore record, a monumental album for me in college. Kevin was 24 at the time, 5 years older than I was. And each subsequent record was like a message from a future self. In 2006, with 3 solo albums already behind him, Devine had also led the Brooklyn punk band Miracle of 86 for much of his early 20s. Kevin Devine signed to Capitol Records, who put out Put Your Ghost to Rest, a buoyantly dark record centering around drugs, addiction, and suicide. He was dropped, as we talk about, but then embarked on a nationwide tour with Brand New and Manchester Orchestra, gaining access to a wide new swath of fans just as the emo wave was cresting. We also talk about that. After mountains of shows all over the world, Devine released Brothers Blood in the spring of 2009. Perhaps the purest distillation yet of his varied musical strengths, pulling in both Nirvana's angry guitars and the hushed gravitas of Elliott Smith, Brothers Blood was just the start. Devine's later Kickstarter was the biggest musical Kickstarter funded at the time, and he used it to put out 2 separate records, Bulldozer and Bubblegum. And then in 2016, he released Instigator. It's 2019, 10 years after Brothers Blood, and I had the opportunity to talk with Kevin about everything: his career, the origin of the song and the record, the realities of the music industry, Britney Spears, Katy Perry, Bob Dylan, and the best compliment / insult he ever received. Kevin is playing Brothers Blood in full on just a few dates. Boston was last night, Philly is tonight, the 14th, and then Friday, December 20th, and Saturday, December 21st in New York. I will be at that show on the 20th. Tickets and merchandise and records and everything is available at kevindevine.net. He's also heading on a European solo tour starting on January 30th in London. But most importantly, go listen to Kevin Devine, especially if you haven't heard his stuff yet. Each album is a great place to start. Each is fantastic. Each is varied. And each shows a new facet of Kevin Devine's talent and his integrity. I'm going to drop in some music from Brothers Blood, including a YouTube recording of the first time he played the title song after he recorded it around Thanksgiving of 2008. We talk about the moment, so I'm going to throw it in. So here, and this is very exciting for me to say, is me and Kevin Devine. So, my first memory of this record was watching you at South By. I live in Austin, and it was March of 2008, I think. And you were playing this like hotel lobby. It was very strange.
Oh, I know exactly what it was. Yep.
Okay, yep. Cool. And even as far as South by gigs go is strange. And you played Another Bag of Bones. Obviously, it was acoustic. And after the first verse, everyone in the room applauded. I responded, I think, to the lyrical content, to the force of it. And I never really seen that before. And I still remember that. So do you remember that time kind of leading up to the recording of this record?
I do. And it's funny. I remember that show. I wish I remembered that moment. I remember other moments around that time connected to some of those songs, but I do remember that was at the Driscoll Hotel, and it was part of something called, I think it was for the Hotel Cafe, this club in LA that like did a branded tour. And I think that was like the last time, this is a weird thing that has like nothing to do with anything, but for about 2 years, I was like socially acquainted friends with Katy Perry. Because she did those sorts of
things. I remember yeah.
And she was
before
there.
Before she was Katy Perry? Yeah. Or like before? Katy Perry was at that show?
Yes. She was like on her way to being. She was always Katy Perry. I met her. Anyway, this is like she was like, when I met her, she was like transitioning from, I think, like a Christian kind of facing pop artist to like, at the time I met her, she was still kind of like, sort of like trying to, you know, Ingrid Michaelson, Rachel Yamagata, playing like guitar and piano and singing kind of person, and was on her way toward like full pop thing. But that's my memory of that show, was that like, I remember it was like, she was down there doing something for Capitol and she was there. And I also remember my, I was like between booking agents, and my 2B, who is still my booking agent to this day, 11 years later, was at that show. But anyway, my memories of that time, I remember writing Another Bag of Bones started as a set of lyrics. I remembered thinking in my head, like the delivery could almost be like hip hop or a little bit like, hip hop by way of like old Modest Mouse, where he was almost, there was like a kind of hip hop cadence to some of what he did back when at a different time for that band. And the imagery came pretty like, I don't know, pretty like, it was pretty fluid. And I remember showing it to Mike Skinner, who was in the goddamn band and Miracle of 86 forever and worked on Brothers Blood. And I remember showing it to him on the tour we did in the spring of 2007, not the song, just the words. And that was when we were on tour with Brand New and Manchester Orchestra for the first time, 2007 spring. And I remember being in the back of a cab with him and showing him my phone and being like, I'm writing this thing, I don't know. And he was like, I don't know how you turn that into a song, but that's really something you should really push to make that something. That's like something. And then I remember when I got into the actual like very beginning phases of demoing stuff for that record. And I mean, beginning as in like me alone with whatever little crummy recording situation I had going on. I remember Chris Bracco, who is still an intermittent collaborator of mine and who also worked on all those records. He was like, him and Skinner were kind of like a producing team. Chris came over to my apartment and just sort of set up a mic in my living room. And I just did whatever songs I had. And when I did that one, that was one of the ones that I've done. I did where I asked him like, hey, is this a song? Because in my mind, I like a lot of different things, but I think there's like a setting in my mind that really loves the, like, I'm a person who's always going to be indebted to the like Beatles, Elliot Smith. Like there's a structure to what a song means in my head. And something like that was just, it was one repeated guitar line for 4 minutes, and this and it had an arc and dynamics, but anyway, but it wasn't like a folk song in that way where there's like a resolve at the end of each verse, or I don't know, it just felt, and Chris was like, oh, not only is that a song, that's like going to be like one of the centerpieces of whatever the record is. Like, I remember that clearly. He was like, oh, that's like a, and so I started to play it out the first time we ever headlined the Bowery Ballroom, which was January of 2008. And that was like the very end of Put Your, that was not even the end of, I toured Put Your Ghost to Rest kind of through 2008. So it was like still sort of on that record loosely. And I played it as the first song of the encore. And I do remember that vividly being like, the thing you're describing happening in Austin happened then. After the first verse, it was like one of those things where people, and you know, I have a really attentive and generous, and I think smart audience. Like, I think I have an audience of, there's not millions of them, but the ones that are there are like really there and a lot, and they listen. And they, I, at a show, a headlining show, like there will be times where people are like really responsive to certain lyrical cues or whatever, but that was definitely foreign. That was like, oh, this is the holy shit, you know? And that's one of those moments where you're like, oh, this is not just a song. This is like a song. But I do remember, and I remember actually on that little run that deposited me in South by Southwest, I played 4 shows as part of the Hotel Cafe's annual branded tour, which I had done in like 2005 and 6 as well. And one of the shows I played, so the Hotel Cafe thing would be like, people would get up and do 3 songs. There was a house band. People would get up and do 3 songs with the house band, and it would rotate. You'd get up twice in a night. And they were big shows by them, because the Hotel Cafe had been involved. Like, some of the artists were on like the Garden State soundtrack, and and then like Ingrid Michaelson had gotten big, and Sarah Bareilles was getting big, and all that stuff. And they were all people who came through that club. Katie Tunstall kind of was connected to that. So I'm not punk enough to be a punk, not emo enough to be emo, not indie rock enough to be indie rock enough, not a singer-songwriter enough to be a singer-songwriter. I'm some weird thing in the middle. I could go do shit like that sometimes. So I went and did it. And one of the things that I remember about Another Bag of Bones and that time period as we were leading up to recording Brothers Blood was I happened to pull that night the 3-song set after Ingrid did her first set. And she was so clearly drawing like 70% of the people at those shows. And she finished her first set with that really lovely song of hers that was kind of ubiquitous around then, The Way You Are, or The Way I Am, or I can't remember the name of it.
Like that,
Really, really pretty song. And she was really, she was very nice to me, that person. But I remember being like, oh, no matter what the fuck I do right now, it's just not going to, I'm effectively getting up after the song that 80% of these people came here to see. So I just was like, well, I'm just going to fucking open with Another Bag of Bones. And that was like when it had not come out yet. It was not. And I just remember being like, that's something I could do, is like kind of try to be like the bucket of ice water to the room that is also like, you know, the punkest thing I could think of to do was to play that song. And I remember it had the effect of about 200 of the 1,000 people in the room kind of being like, whoa, and about 800 people being like, this is not why I got a babysitter tonight, you know? So, but I do remember that. I remember that song kind of moving around in a way that was like an indication of the tone or energy of things. But
That's awesome. The records start, I think it's a good kind of segue into the records start. The first line of the record is, this is a window where I watch the future start. And if I don't know your life, obviously, but I have been a fan of yours for a long time, and sort of know your career a bit. And looking back kind of at your life and career, you had like the 4 albums in 4 years from 2002 to 2006. 1986, and you had the big tour with Brand New in Manchester, which I think a lot of people from the, I don't know, emo scene kind of discovered you, I think. And then you were signed and dropped by Capitol. And then I think maybe I kind of remember around this time, maybe you were starting to get sober. I don't know. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Oh, I don't care. That was happening somewhere. The sober thing was like, that's all true. And the sober thing was kind of happening concurrent to a lot of that, like kind of like June of 2005 was when that started. The attempt started. It did not really take until like May of 2008, but I was like in and out of that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been sober for like a year and a half now. And, mine had a similar journey of kind of starting. Mine was like a year, like starting a year ahead and then it not sticking. And then finally, nailing it.
Which is amazing.
So, yeah. Thanks. But all these things are going on. Did this record feel like either then or like now when you look back on it as a sort of rebirth?
It's a funny thing because, you know, the temptation when you look back at stuff like that is to almost like affix a kind of clarity to your motives or your thought processes and so you have to like resist the temptation to do that wherever possible. But I will say I genuinely remember talking about this with the people who worked on that record with me. I had my audience is still what I think would be described by certain metrics as modest, you know, for sure. But my audience then was like really just establishing itself. And, you know, like when the Capitol thing happened, there was a sense that like, I kind of see in retrospect that I was like one of the last people of my ilk to sort of get in the door and get to even like make a record like that for a label like that. And I sort of think like from a business perspective, the reason that happened was because there were like these like sort of mainstream singer-songwriters, like, I don't know, like James Blunt or like David Gray or I don't know, whatever, all that. And then the Hotel Cafe stuff was playing a role in that too. And then also, you know, there was like Sufjan Stevens and Conor Oberst and Iron and Wine. And there was this stuff that was like above ground, underground in music that was like, you know, extremely popular.
Yeah.
And like, was it being attached to by like NPR and places like that? Legitimized. It wasn't like punk. It wasn't just for kids. It was like tasteful grownups could buy I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning or whatever. So
even,
I think
even stuff like Modest Mouse breaking out, I think
100%.
Like those records. That was a big one, I think, because they sounded really different than what was out there.
And also I think on, you know, some of the people who were working in the music industry at that point were still holdovers from places that like signed people like Elliot Smith or Built to Spill or whatever. So there was this last little gasp of like a tasteful singer-songwriter who may or may not be commercially successful, but who we can probably get to a certain place developmentally, got signed to. And then really I was there like as that moment. Oh, and I think a big thing with all that too was like the whole Wilco thing. Wilco's whole story.
Right.
So I think that they were kind of like placing bets on people like me for a moment.
Right.
Like maybe this guy will be something like that. And then I was really there at the moment where that like the scythe fell really hard on that. And so when it did, like the things I knew were like, I knew I really thought that record was a good record. I knew I really knew I had some audience.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how sustainable it was, but I knew there were people that liked it. I knew if I got up in front of people and played with conviction and played my songs and translated them well, I had the capacity to earn more of them.
Right.
And I knew that you know, my peers really liked me. Like I was somebody who had like, and still, I think if it's probably dangerous to assess yourself like this, but I like just because who the, you're not, you're like the least equipped person in the room to talk about yourself. But it does seem to me that I'm a person who has like a lot of fans that make music. So
yeah.
I think that I kind of had a sense that like I would be able to like see, I would be able to like at the very least extend the death rattle.
Uh-huh.
But the genuine thought was like, oh, maybe I'm, this is it. Like maybe I'm not gonna, I don't know, maybe this record lives in limbo in the like, basement of EMI forever and on some hard drive and I never can do anything with it again. Maybe no one's going to want to, maybe I'll be thought of in the music industry proper as like non-starter, unworth, I don't know. I just, you don't know. Or, and you're also like, I don't know, maybe my audience will, maybe I don't have an audience. Maybe it'll shrivel up and die. Maybe people don't like you. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So what I think happened for like, from February 2007 until we recorded Brothers Blood, which was August of 2008, was I effectively took that record on my back and brought it everywhere. I brought it and I did things that were like first of four, get up and play a 25 song acoustic set when the doors were opening. I probably did like 400 shows in like 550 calendar days or something like that, like all over the world. I was in a relationship that was kind of coming apart for other reasons. And it really came apart around my sobriety stuff and just around some natural causes. But, but I also, because that shifted, there was, I just sort of really threw myself into it. And I think that what happened was I earned like an armful at a time, enough of an audience and enough like in the independent music industry support to be like, oh, I can actually sort of do this. And also capital, because we had one lawyer there that really liked us and thought we were like easy to work with and efficient and like not good people. We got that record back like fairly immediately. So we were able to like do things with it, you know, like right almost right away. So all of this is a lot of pretext to say, because it was a very fertile time. All this is a lot of pretext to say, like, I do remember having the thought that like, maybe we'll never get to make, I don't know, maybe I don't know what you think, but I thought like, maybe we'll never get to make another record again, or maybe there'll be some serious, like, I don't know. And so what I do remember thinking with Brothers Blood was like, sort of like, don't worry. Like whatever comes out of it comes out of it. And so if you are, and it almost reminds me of like stories I've heard about like not a surf around Let Go and stuff like that. There's this moment where you're like, well, I'm just going to put everything on here and whatever, if it is, if someone's going to put it out, even if we just put it out on our own, I'm just going to like put everything on here. And I did know that at that point I wanted to make like a pivot away from like a sort of purely folk rock sound and do something that kind of was a little more experimental in places, a little more muscular in places, not like a properly like, you know, not like a thick rock band, but a little more mercurial. Put Your Ghost to Rest was intentionally, and I feel Rob, you know, I think it's a beautiful record that was intentionally very mannered. That record was meant to be mannered because I was trying to like make, I wanted to make a record like that. I wanted to see what it would be like to try to make like a grown ass record, you know, and something that was like stately. and so no, I do remember thinking though, like, this gets to be whatever I want it to be. And I kind of was like, oh, right. It's funny that I ever even momentarily would have thought anything else, because it always could have been whatever I wanted it to be. And it always sort of was. And now, and so was that record. And now I get to do something different. Now, whether or not it was going to be Stillborn or whether or not it was going to be, that was a completely different unknowable thing. But I do remember thinking like, it was a chance to hit reset because reset got hit for me. So you can either like lean into it or you could like fucking fight the world about it.
I could be with anyone, so all the honeymoon burns bright. No electricity that keeps things light, and I'm not saying that it's right, or saying that it's always right. I'm just saying that it's not a lie. I could talk to anyone, care just enough about her wounded pride, her ballerina dreams and lead foot life, her sugar daddy and his clueless wife. And I know that it's not right, I just don't always know how, why. 'Cause I could stick to anyone, at least for a little. Sharp and deep, a tempting sample of who I could be, without the broken glasses waiting underneath. So I'd walk soft if I were you. You could cut up your feet, for now it's just what I am, but it's not what I'll be.
Was it frustrating at the time? I mean, you have like, it kind of seems like when you did play shows, which you played a lot of and kind of got in front of people liked you, bands liked you. Was it frustrating that you couldn't get in, if only I could get in front of more people? Or like, why is this, like, it seems like you've really earned your audience, which I think is incredible and really speaks to your authenticity and kind of genuineness. But was it frustrating at times that it wasn't happening like it was for other people?
Oh, I mean, dude, listen, if we're being completely candid and honest, one of the cardinal lessons of my entire adult life, and it's certainly been centrally and constantly, I've been abundantly given the opportunity to practice this lesson over and over again, is that like the more time I spend looking at somebody else's yard,
yeah,
the more time I am certain to find myself to be lacking less than a fuck up, or to find myself to be like somebody who deserved better and is like, mm-hmm, you know, hot shit, but didn't get. Here's what I think though. Because yeah, of course that was frustrating. And by the way, that frustration isn't necessarily like, or the circumstances that could cause frustration, they haven't necessarily ever changed. Like, I still sometimes feel like if I could only get a tiny desk concert, if right, I could only right, be, but then there's also part of me that's like, I remember talking about some of this stuff on a tour once with a friend of mine named Jay Russo. And Jay used to play in the band. What the fuck was that band from Mercury Rev? And he played, and he has a band called Guiding Light. He had a band called Hopewell, and Jay played bass for me for a couple of years and recorded the Instigator record with me. And he's probably 5, 6, 7 years older than me. And he's seen a lot and he's been around a lot. And he's somebody who, between you and I, also shares our other shared character trait, but he has good stuff. And one of the things he said to me was like, oh, you're first, he said after the first tour we did together, he's like, man, watching you work up close, it might actually be easier for you if you like made widgets in a factory somewhere. He's like, you actually work really fucking hard. It kind of puts us to shame. But then he was like, but also you're not supposed to. He basically was like, you're meant to be in what he called the priest caste. He was like, you're not supposed to be like somebody who's like struggling with questions of fame, because you then get to do what you do the way you do it. And you also get to be somebody who can kind of be a power of example to maybe people in his life who are wrestling with some of those questions. And that can be its own ego trip, so I can't attach too much to that either. But I did understand what he was getting at. And I, here's what, but do I sometimes wish, what's another way to say that? Do I think if you took my, the best stuff, do I think I have made a consistently compelling and wide ranging body of work? I mm-hmm. do. Do mm-hmm. I think if I put the highlights of that body of work up against literally anybody in the last 15 years who is doing either like indie rock, in emo, or singer, songwriter, like do I think it compares favorably? I do. Mm-hmm. Do I think my work ethic speaks for itself? I yeah. do. I'm not an especially, like, I don't mean this just in like a, I'm not a very sexy story. I'm not somebody who like mm-hmm. gets up and tries to like, I've always been a lot more comfortable to just do the thing than to do. And not, that doesn't mean like you've, you know, I try to hold the space when I play live, and I can be, I don't mean to say that I'm like a passive person, but I just mean it more like, I'm not going to get up there and like, and there is a little bit of a contrarian streak in me sometimes. So I think that, I think there's some, a lot of it's circumstance, I think a lot, but I don't think it's like you haven't made a good record or right. you haven't.
Right.
But do I think sometimes like, look, I'm not, I live in reality, you know,
right.
you know, like Manchester Orchestra, the Front Bottoms, Pine Grove, you could list probably five other, I don't know, maybe more bands that like opened for me at some point that are like by a factor of exponents more popular commercially than I am. Then they're all wonderful bands. I don't have, I'm not shit talking any of those bands, but I'm saying like, I don't, but then like, I remember watching an interview with Bazan once, and they asked him like, would you rather be opening for 10,000 people with Death Cab or playing a Bazan show in front of 50 people in a club? And of course you can't answer, I'd rather be playing a Bazan show in front of 10,000 people, you know? And he was like, okay, honestly, I'd rather open for, I'd rather play for the 50 people in the club, because those 50 people, I know what they're doing there. Right. And I know what that feels like, and I know what I'm doing there. I love Ben, I love Death Cab, but some nights when we're doing a show like that, I'm watching 8,500 people fully not give a shit about what I'm doing. And right. and I can certainly really, and so your job is to try to get them to give a shit, and you can do that to the best of your ability. But another thing you and I are aware of is I have no control over outcomes or results ever. I have control over my effort. So I go back, you know, what I really think is this, like, I never became a like rich, wealthy rock star
yet.
But the most often, well, thank you. That's like my booking agent who is, I was like, he said to me, he's like a pretty realist, pretty yeah. brutal guy. Yeah. But one day I said something about like, I can't remember how I said, but I was like, I'm probably not going to open. I'm probably not going to be headlining Madison Square Garden anytime soon. And he was mm-hmm. like, never say never. And I was like, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. But I've made a living in New York City from music. And I haven't had another job since 2005. And I've had many other jobs, don't get me wrong, but I have not since 2005. Like, whatever the, when they talk about a life beyond your, and I've gotten to do it basically doing, I have never written a single song that I was like, I have to write this song because people will like it if I write this song. Never. So if that's, and I fucking play guitar music, which is like every year gets like less popular by half. So if that's a thing, I don't know, we're all going to die. And I feel like this is about the best, like if you had told me when I was 11 years old, this is what it'll look like when you're nearing 40, I would have been like, fuck, all right, cool. Well, certainly if you told me by the time I knew about like Superchunk and Helium and Pavement, and if you were like, yo, you can essentially be that band when you're 40, I would be like, sick, that sounds fantastic. So, but do I, but sorry, a lot of words, I tend to be that way. Do I ever think that people, do I ever wish that more people liked it? Yeah, of course. Do I ever wish that I, certain opportunities that I think are afforded to people I consider to be peers were afforded to me as well? I do. I don't fully understand certain things because they're, I guess, but what I've realized is like, they're not for me to understand. I don't know why certain like media outlets have effectively never really fucked with my stuff,
right,
or like,
right,
or like flirted very, very tangentially with it.
Yeah.
I know Brothers Blood was a moment where we got, you know, your Brothers Blood was a shift for me where I got like more attention from those places than I had. And then it's come and gone with each record. It's not like once, and then there were still places on Brothers Blood, which at the time of Brothers Blood were like super influential that didn't even acknowledge its existence at all. So
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to know what the hell happens.
It's hard to, I mean, I definitely have thoughts. It seems that you don't enjoy too much taking compliments. You seem a little bit tough on yourself, but I will say that you which I think is it, like, you're a very humble person. I think that other people in your situation might have just quit or not, you know, gone on, and certainly not continued experimenting. I think your music demands a listener's attention, mm-hmm, in a way, uh-huh, that a lot of music doesn't. And so I think that if people don't have like the context of who you are and they're coming in thinking of you as whatever's been attached to you over the years. Yeah.
Yes.
Like then they might miss a lot of the context and a lot of kind of, it's like, oh, it's like, why are these, you know, 850 people not paying attention? It's like, you know, because you're doing something very different than even like Ben Gibbard, who's again like fantastic, but writes, you know, essentially like pop songs. And so
I think you know, it's funny. Somebody recently in my personal life said to me that I was being minimizing when they were trying to tell me something, and it wasn't like a fight. It was more someone being like observational, like, oh, you have a hard time hearing that. And I'm trying to get better at that. So I appreciate you saying that. Cause what I think is like, I think that's true. And I think it's a little dangerous to think that much about yourself. We're all fucking imprisoned by ourselves. Don't get me wrong. I think about myself all fucking day, but to think about myself that way, I feel like could turn into its own like inverse ego trip. Because I'll tell you this, the most egotistical thing I've, and it's okay, it's okay, we all have egos and I have one too. The thing I think from time to time that sneaks in about my career is that I'm like, you know, I'm going to be one of those people that like 30 years from now, somebody's like, holy shit, there's this treasure trove of stuff this guy did that was really good and thoughtful. And then you could have this like late, you know, you whether that's like your Leonard Cohen moment or, mm-hmm, or whatever moment, not that I'm putting myself in the class of Leonard Cohen, who I think is like the greatest lyricist of all time, but you know what I'm saying? So I think when that starts to sneak around, what I really have to do is just like write another song or like, yeah, go for a run or something. But,
right,
but I think that I do. What you have said has been said to me by people I trust, and I can share a story with you to that end about another story about another bag of bones, which is that when I was writing Brothers Blood, the man who signed me to Capitol to make Put Your Ghost Trust was a guy whose name was Dan McCarroll. And Dan used to be a drummer. He played with David Bowie at one point. He had a band called The Grays. And there was a canceled pilot in 2000, 2001 or something for VH1 that John Bryan was going to have his own show. And John Bryan was going to have different musical guests on. They were going to like talk about music, play a bunch of songs together. And Elliot Smith was the pilot. And on this pilot, they're doing like songs from EXO and Figure Eight and covers and stuff. And Dan McCarroll is the percussionist. So this guy, Dan McCarroll, signs me to Capitol. He knew all of the things to say. And I was a kid who came from punk and hardcore and indie rock. And I was pretty suspicious of the whole enterprise. And he still knew all of the things to say. And after I got dropped, I did not see Dan for almost a year, which is kind of a bummer because I actually thought of him as a bit, I'm sure this is how everybody's fucking story is, but I thought he was like more of a friend at that point.
Right. Yeah.
Even a mentor.
I've had the same experience with like bosses and stuff where it's like, oh, but this was way different than I thought. And it's like, was that my fault or was that, wait, what happened?
So, I guess we're not actually those people. Cool.
Yeah.
But so. Anyway, we reconnected actually at that South by Southwest that you are talking about. And, so that was about a year after I was dropped. He's living in New York at this point, and he's like becomes the head of EMI publishing, music publishing. So we're going to make Brothers Blood. I have this batch of songs. I send him like Carnival, Bag of Bones, All of Everything Erased, I Could Be With Anyone. I send them like four or five songs. And by the way, when I went in to do a few demos for Capitol in the summer of 2005 in their Studio B, and I have to like chase this recording if it exists somewhere. There is a version I did that day of Brothers Blood.
Of the song Brothers Blood?
Yes.
Back in 2005.
I only had the first verse of that song. And I just was recording stuff in like the studio that like, you know, the Beach Boys and Frank Sinatra and all these people. So I was like, oh, let me do this song. And I remember it went somewhere totally different. Like totally different change. And I didn't have the big climactic ending. Like it was a different song. And I need to chase that down. So anyway, Dan, I send him these songs and he calls me in for a meeting. And I go into this building in Chelsea. I forget what it doesn't matter. Chelsea Market or something. And I go in there and they have an office there. And I go in to have a meeting with him. And when I get there, Dan says, plays another Bag of Bones. He's like, this song is fucking incredible. I was like, oh, thank you. He's like, you're the only person I know that I've ever worked with that would write this song. And then he sat back and he's like, I published Ben Gibbard. I didn't mind this. This was like frank and honest. He was like, Ben Gibbard is like this. And I like Ben and I know Ben. He was like, Ben Gibbard is like the more sort of like polished, presentable, and like, you know, at that point, you know, like still to this day, but at that point, certainly he was like, you know, 100 times more commercially identifiable than you are. And I can't get Ben Gibbard's songs placed adequately. Huh. Do you know what song gets placed the most of anything in my catalog annually? And I was like, I do not. And he was like, Walking on Sunshine. He was like, how am I going to get another Bag of Bones in film, music, television, advertising, whatever?
Right.
Or how am I going to justify giving you like a $50,000 publishing advance or something even if I think you're the best songwriter, he said, I think you're the best songwriter not enough people know. And I, right. It struck me that this was a man who was literally sitting with the pocketbook of one of the four major multinational music corporations in his hand.
Right.
And he was telling me he felt powerless to help me in my career because what I was doing was exactly what you just described to me as what your assessment of my music is. And I will agree with you that that could, I remember leaving and being like, why the fuck did I have to go there for that? Right. Why couldn't you just called me and told me that? There were a few meetings I had like that with people where I was like, why did I come? You could have just said that over the phone. But, and that's not to shit talk Dan. I have mixed feelings about how things went down with Dan, but he's just a person. He was just trying to do his job and figure stuff out. And honestly, in some way, like I kind of think all of that stuff just made me more certain of what I wanted to do, and also made it so that whenever I did have, like when our records chart on Billboard or when we get like, when we play like the main stage at Lollapalooza or when we like, you know, do things that are like music industrial accomplishment oriented things, I just feel like it's like we're like insurrectionists that like won the lottery or something. Not that it's like a Make-A-Wish Foundation thing. Like I deserve to be anywhere I am, but then I'm like, I know how we got here and it's like fucking, and I'll still go play a show. You know, I'm a guy who, if I, outside of the major cities, if I, I'm like, sometimes it's like 100 to 200 people. That's like, if I go play a show in Lawrence, Kansas, I'm not playing for like 700, 2000 people. Right. I'm playing for like 150 kids. But that's what I found is you can actually have a really rewarding life in music playing to 150 kids everywhere. And then playing to 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 in the places where that happens. But like, so anyway, that's a lot of data, a lot of thinking. But yeah, I think that so of course it's frustrating sometimes, but it's also like super out of my control. And the things I have been able to do and have been afforded are like inarguable and obvious and plain to see, you know?
That's really interesting. I think it tracks a lot with what, sort of as a creative person, I do the podcast, but I also write, and I'm writing a novel. And I think there's like, I've always thought of like, there's this level of like both self-confidence and like, and delusion also that you need in order to be an artist. Like we're at the same time, like very critical of ourselves, because we have to be, right? We're the one person who can say like, that's a bad idea. Like we shouldn't do that. But at the same time, we have to have this like sort of delusion side of like, oh, out of all the books written, you know, in all the world, especially by like, 33 year old white guy, like, this is the one that I think people should read. You know what I mean? And like, so there's a delusion factor, I think, there. And so I kind of hear that, and you as well, where at once you're both, don't allow yourself to be compared to some of your, contemporaries, Elliot Smith and Leonard Cohen and all that. But at the same time, you're like, I absolutely deserve to be here. And hey, like maybe I deserve to be other places too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that sounds and feels right. And I also can't even imagine writing a novel just sounds like it sounds to me like trying to like escape Alcatraz or something. But I do think that to me, it's almost about dismantling the idea that anybody needs to hear any of it. Like I feel like, but not because I don't understand exactly what you're talking about, because of course I do. But the thing is, like, in truth, there's been a minor miracle that's been performed in my career, which is that I am still changing people's perceptions of me 10 records into my career.
But don't you think that's not, like, to me, that's not a miracle. It's like, you and your hard work and you've continued to do. Like, I'm sitting here with a list of your albums, and like each one is like pretty fucking different from the last.
But the thing I would say about that is, look at the cultural moment we live in. Look at the way people digest things or don't digest things.
Yeah.
And the industry that I'm in, people decide who you are. If you even get to a third record, people have pretty much decided what you are. And I don't just mean audience. The audience probably is the most flexible of anybody, but, or at least the core audiences. And Looky Loos, it's cool because like there's people that I literally have people come in that are like, oh, I only know, and then pick any record from the 15 year timeline. And they're like, oh, I got like, you know, there's 22 year old kids that are like, I only know Bubblegum or Instigator. Then there's people that are my age that are like, oh, I haven't listened to a record of yours since Split the Country, Split the Street, or, you know, and you're like, oh, well, that's cool. There's a lot to catch up on. But like, but I think that the minor miracle is that like, it often doesn't happen that wheel, it doesn't mean you can't have a career in an audience, but I think I think there are people who consider my stuff more seriously now than they did at one time, who were absolutely not on track to consider my stuff seriously at all. Right. At a certain point, I think there are people who also made, I think, you know, the association thing is a blessing and a curse. Without saying anything about anything else, because it's not necessary, I, of course, like Brand New and their endorsement changed my life with music. It didn't change my life like I had no audience before that, or anybody now who knows me through them. That's not exclusive, but there's a large swath of my audience that obviously connects me most directly with Brand New and Manchester Orchestra. And I have nothing but gratitude for that in both instances. That being said, I always thought that the connection with a band like Brand New was more like philosophical, attitudinal than it even was aesthetic at times. Right. That does not mean there weren't moments where I could see someone who likes one of any of those bands being like, oh, I could like that. But I also could see things I've made that like, and I know from playing with those bands, that there are times I've gotten up and played some of my stuff and there's people who just don't get it. And I also definitely know that there's people who like certain things about my music that don't like things about those bands musically. So, but I also know they were the largest act to ever, and so committedly like put their like arm around me.
Yeah.
And so for better and for worse, And in many instances, it's been for better. And in some instances, I think, you know, prior to the last couple of years, but I think it's funny. In 2007, I think it was actually like, I will say this there for another Austin story, and a band who I will not name, with whom I had and continue to have a positive friendly relationship with, but who was a cooler band, came to see that tour, the Brand New at Stubbs, Brand New Manchester at Me, came to see me, and backstage we were sitting talking, and this person said, "What's it like?" and waved their hand in the air, like as if they had like a snifter of brandy in their hand, and said, "What's it like touring with these bands?"
Oh, interesting.
And so the vibe there is if you were like an indie rock person who was my age or older in 2005, 6, 7, it was not a cool association at all to be associated with a band like Brand New. It did not matter to them that I would be like, you should go watch them play. Like, this is not the thing you think it was in 2002 or whatever. I didn't like that either. But this is not that. And they only got more interesting. So anyway, I feel like, but I also know that there was a whole legion of people that were like, oh, they really like this guy, I should check his music out. And so it is what it is. I, you know, if at that time in my career, like the Shins had been like, this is a great songwriter. Let's take them on tour all over the place. Would that have been like a cooler thing? Probably, but I don't know. I don't know if it was a cooler thing come 2015 when like a reassessment had happened and people were like, oh, actually like that there band's really good.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that my thing has just enabled me to sort of just the nicest thing anyone ever said about my career was probably meant as a shot. But when I did Lollapalooza in 2009, the Time Out Chicago did a thing where they like broke down what each band on Lollapalooza was that year based on their, like they categorized, and it was like, you know, big shot headliner, middle of the road, major label act that's, you know, being, that's opening a main stage for no reason, you know, whatever, like some of it was snarky, some of it was positive. And after they did literally every single act, the end of the article was, because it was like thing, colon, band, you know, and mine just said Kevin Devine.
Yes, dude, but I felt that same way. Yeah, to me, that's great.
Oh, it's the best. And I don't know if what they were saying was like, we don't even know what to do with this person, or we don't know. And it's funny because I don't make music that's like, and Brothers Blood in a lot of respects, I would make the argument that every record has been its own experiment. Brothers Blood was the record, and like genre exercises or like ways to stretch certain songs for certain reasons. Brothers Blood is the record that I can, to me, the record that's the weirdest record and it holds a special place in my heart. It's subtle in its weirdnesses is Concrete and Clouds. That's a record that I think is actually like properly like, there's some shit going on that record that I think I've had peers of mine be like, that's the first record I heard of yours where I was like, and I mean this as a compliment, I was like, I have no idea what the fuck he's doing on that song. But like Brothers Blood, that was the, we really stretched some shit out sonically on that record. And, but I don't make experimental music. I'm experimenting with something that is very formal, which is what my definition of a song is. But I think that the best thing I could say for myself is I think that I've been dogged in my commitment to iterating that in a different, to challenging myself to not become a nostalgia act or to not repeat myself, even though you're always repeating yourself, but you know what I mean? Capital R, repeat yourself. So I don't know, but anyway, I'm working on the compliments thing, but all, but yeah, I think those things are fair and appropriate.
My brother's blood boils in my arms. It balls my fingers into fists. It bubbles, blisters, burns my palms. It floods with fury, fights and fits. It's got the good guy in me hiding. It kicks my humble heart around. It's got me fiending for the fire that could finish off this town. Oh, it's got me good. It's my brother's blood on a cherry tree. It stains the bark from branch to root. It puddles thick with pits and leaves. It strains the sweetness from the fruit. It's got got me looking for communion, a hiding spot off underground, an open plot I could climb into, a lightning promise in my mouth, a blackout oath I swore and meant, but couldn't conjure up again. I don't know one thing about my brother's blood, no. I don't know one thing about my brother's blood. My father's gun on each stranger's face, across the bluebird sky, on every hand I shake, night after night, with each chuckled prayer, such sweet relief, a fist full of hair, and each desperate drive for elusive peace, and every endless night, and every wasted week, all that dialogue doubling back on me. All that tale talk, all my growling need. It's my brother's back, it's my father's arms, it's every twisted fact in my sorry heart, my sorry heart, my sorry heart. Go make your peace with everyone. They don't need to know about my brother's blood. No, they don't need to know about my brother's blood.
I'd love to talk about Brothers Blood, the song.
I
definitely didn't know it was around for as long as it was, but kind of in talking and I mean, it really feels like maybe not the centerpiece like of your career, but kind of like a centerpiece, you know, at least a signpost. And I was just wondering, like, when you were writing, were you recording it? Certainly when you're writing it back in the day, and then when you started to record it for the actual record, like, did you feel the weight of it back then? Or was it just sort of another kind of, you know, not experiment, but like you said, another playing with the form and exploring things?
I remember that song started. I wrote the first verse or verse and a half or something of that song on the subway in like 2005. And I have like, I remember there's like a notebook somewhere where there's like the first, probably the first verse. And I didn't really finish it. I didn't know what it was. I knew it felt like a thing. And then I did that early version of it, but never really chased that down or pursued it. It didn't feel like it was for that group of songs. I finished the form at some point early 2008, I would imagine, because I remember the first time I did a tour with Skinner and Mike Strandberg, who still plays with me. And Mike plays a few things with me. He's an incredible guitar player, but he plays bass with me sometimes too. He's an incredible bassist too. What I mean is he's like, sometimes I waste him on bass because I don't need a guitarist for that. But, but he, we did a 3-piece tour in Europe in May of 2008, which is the last time I drank and did drugs was on that tour. But it was a pretty relentless tour. It was like 21 shows in 22 days over 7 countries or something.
Yeah.
And I remember we played a show in an airplane hangar, it felt like, in a place called Sankt Pölten or something, Austria. And there was I remember walking in, it was like a 1300 capacity room. And I was like, why are we fucking playing here? There's no way this is right. And it was just like, sometimes that's like, there was not a lot of places in town and they wanted the show. And so they put you in that room. And they know, like, this guy might bring 50 people to this show, but that's what right. It's going to be tonight. And I remember, because it was so ridiculous, we had started jamming on Brothers Blood in sound checks. And I mean jamming, like, unformed, fully unformed. But it had that Neil Young Crazy Horse energy to it. And I remember being like, let's play that song we've been doing in sound checks. And that was the first time we played it. We just, like... And it just sort of like, after the parts I knew, which were like the first two verses, we just kind of made noise for 5 minutes or something. But and then when I came back home, and I think I finished the structure lyrically and added those the changes that are in there with the other part, the Blackout Oath, made it a bit more of a song. I played it at a show at a club in Hamden, Connecticut called The Space, and opened with it. And I remember people really responded to that. And then I remember after we recorded it, I played it for the first time in New York at a show around Thanksgiving at the Music Hall of Williamsburg. And it was with Jesse and Brian Bonds. It was like the end of a tour we did together. And I opened with it, and I remember doing the end, so like the solo, and that I remember being the same kind of thing as Bag of Bones, where like people, like there was like spontaneous applause. And right. I kind of keep thinking that's going to stop happening, but that's been happening for 11 years intermittently at those shows, which is really wonderful. Not expected. And when it doesn't happen, that's great too. But I'm always kind of like, but what I knew by the time we got into recording, and by the time, so the band on Brothers Blood is myself on guitar and vocals. And then, like, you know, when you record, I messed around with a bunch of other little things, but that's the bulk. Strandberg played guitar and a little bit of like mandolin, I think. Brian Bonds did like atmospheric key stuff. Sang some harmonies, did percussion. Chris Bracco played bass and co-produced. Mike Skinner played drums and co-produced. And Russell Smith played electric guitar. And so that was like, we were exploring this 3-guitar thing.
Yeah.
And that's, you hear that on like Carnival and Bag of Bones and Your Husband and Brothers Blood and I Could Be With Anyone. The rock songs, really, you really hear it. And it's happening on stuff like Murphy's Song too. It's just a subtler iteration of it. But so when Brothers Blood started to take shape as a band song, and all I really knew was like Neil Young, Cortez the Killer, but like louder. Less not like a 70s jammy thing, but like something with a bit more snarl and teeth to it. But that's the goal. I knew it said what I wanted it to say because I didn't know what I wanted it to say until it got said, if that makes sense. And then I was like, oh, that's like saying something I don't even know how to completely articulate, like it's getting under something that I can't even like get at. So it's almost like subconscious or something. So, and I thought these string of images was powerful. And I thought the melodic structure was strong I thought the dynamics were strong. And when we got into the band thing, it was clear that it could be like a really like a motherfucker, you know? And you know, so much credit belongs with the players on every record. And I recognize that like, I have to provide the material and like help organize and like, you know, be like the driving sort of impetus with like the vision or whatever, and that there's nothing to build on if there are no songs. But you are all what you're as, you know, when you're playing with a band, the band is every bit is, you know, you're collaborating and people are, and that is a band record in so many ways. It's a songwriter record, but it's a band record in so many ways. And, you know, I felt the weight of the song, and sometimes you can't fully feel the weight of the song until it's reflected back to you. But I remember the reflections that came were like when we did the demoing, and you're like rehearsing in shitty rehearsal spaces. Or they had not heard the lyrics clearly, and they had also not fully tracked my, like, tries and like followed, listened to, heard closely my, like, the end of that, the last vocal part. And when we did the demos, which would have been June maybe of 2008, that I remember being a moment where people were like, in the band, were like, dude, that's, yo, wow, that just unexpectedly got me like slightly emotional. They were like, I remember them being like, yo, that's fucking crazy. Or like, that's a, you know, that, you know, kind of like reacting to the vocal thing and the lyrical content. And, you know, everyone's performance on that. Russell does that early teardrop guitar solo, the very first one.
Yeah.
Strandberg does that like fucking like some kind of hybrid of like Jay Mascis and Slash thing that happens, which is like, I don't know anybody else who plays guitar that could play the guitar solo he plays on that song. That is true. I know a lot of excellent guitar players. He's the only person I know who would have played that solo.
Yeah.
And I say that as a person who's been playing a really wonderful, credible, interesting guitar solo when I play that song as the lead guitar player for a long time, but it's not his. It's not his version. His thing is like fucking crazy. But I do remember, you know, I knew the weight. I knew it was like we had this thing in our pocket with that song that I was like, I didn't know what it, I didn't have any illusions that it was going to be Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's a 7.5 minute song that has no chorus. I didn't think it was like, but I did know that it was like impactful. And I also knew that what was super, the challenge to me since the first time I saw Elliott Smith play by himself. Was, and somewhat tacit in like REM's music, and certainly when I was a kid and saw Nirvana play Unplugged, but really when I saw Elliott and then heard his records, was like, it's got to be as good by yourself in a room as it is with five people playing. Like,
that's so interesting.
You have to be able to sit down and play, and have, not every song's gonna fly that, but if you, but the goal is to try to make every song compelling guy with guitar, or compelling whatever other clothes you put on it. And also that the record doesn't have to be like the live show. You can move around. But Brothers Blood, I remember being like, that one was like the most polarizing and in some ways the most successful as either iteration. And so I did know, I don't know what the right language is, if I knew it was like a special song, but I knew it was like something different. And in retrospect, it's not possible for me to act as though now it is not. Like, it's clearly, I would say, again, no artist, I suppose, should move around within himself this much. But I do think, like, if aliens came and said, show me one of your, show me your song. What is your song? I would probably show them Brothers Blood.
Right.
You know, you'd probably be like, this is my song. This is what I did while I was here. And I am comfortable with that. Like, there was definitely a time when I thought with the vocal stress of it, where I was like, am I going to be like somebody who's like 65 trying to play Brothers Blood? And I might be. And I might have to figure out what that looks like, or maybe I'll be lucky and I'll, you know, I can age gracefully with it. But I think that I do think that I am aware, whether I was aware in full of it at the time, I'm aware of it now. I can't act like that song's not like, that song's like that whole record and that whole time, but that song at its core is like a defining pivot. And I don't think it's like, it's funny because you can get into questions of like best. I don't know what that means. I don't know if it's like, are a lot of songs I really like from the catalog that are like not the most popular or obvious ones for various reasons. But I don't ever think with Brothers Blood, I'm never like, oh, this one again. Like, I get right. it. I get yeah. it's a visceral song, and it's a visceral yep. song that's executed with some amount of skill. Yeah. And so those things are not often. Sometimes you have a song that's really visceral but not particularly skillful. Sometimes you could have something that's particularly skillful but doesn't feel like much. That song sort of has both. So I get that.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, I know it's hard to put it into words, but like the lyrical content, I know you struggled with kind of what is it saying even in after it was written and things like that. But can you just talk kind of as much as you would like to about, yeah, what you were saying with it or where the lyrics came from?
The truth is, I don't totally remember the like Genesis point, because actually, sadly, I think I was a little drunk when I wrote the very beginning. I was not drunk when I wrote what became the rest of it, but I think the very beginning, and I don't mind saying that I think the song's a bunch of things, but loosely one of the things I think it is some amount of reckoning with like inherited dysfunction, inherited. Like, I have an older half sibling who was a heroin addict, who was a violent guy, who was in and out of institutions, who died actually, he was my age now when he died, 39. He contracted HIV and eventually that became AIDS. He was also charismatic, sweet, funny. My memories of him were like bringing me and my younger brother to the fucking Our Lady of Angels Catholic Church to watch WrestleMania 2 on closed circuit TV, like having us come over his house and play football with him and buy us like pork rinds and shit. Like I remember him like as that, but I am certain there are a number of people in the world who do not remember him that way, and for good and real reason. I think that by that point I was 7 or 8 years into my own research mm-hmm. with some of those things. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was prompted by, you know, and it's like, there's no nationality or faith background has the market cornered on any of what I'm about to say, but these are my signifiers, and I parochial, provincial, outer borough, Irish Catholic people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bloodline, a lot of inheritance, and I think from that part about my brother, it got to open out more broadly into like even things about like the sort of like brutality that Irish people have, or the sort of the sadness and gristle in there. And then you kind of open the aperture even further to things that are not you, and just sort of about like the shared experience of personhood. And then it also drills super down into like my dad had passed by that time, mm-hmm. my brother had passed by that time, mm-hmm. Seeing the ways in which you are those people for better and sometimes for worse, and physicalizing some of those things and that last section is just like a sort of stream of images that collect into the weight of inheritance, the weight of personhood. And I think if I was going to say what is the vast majority of what I write is about, the weight of personhood and the different ways. And I think if I ever was to say, what was it that you did? I would say that every couple of years, I like documented what it was like to be a person and I don't have a claim to what it's like for the other 7.5 billion people, but I think some things about us are pretty common. So, I tried to make a log of an artful, poetic, not journal oriented log to music that was compelling and well arranged, hopefully, and dynamic, not like just like me puking in a tape, but you know, while I like strum a detuned C chord or something, like I wanted to be good at all of those things. But I also thought that like, if I could offer a picture of what it's like to be a person, then I did my, not only did I do my job, but I did it. That's what feels the closest to the middle for me as a person making stuff. So, but I think Brothers Blood in a lot of ways is like a pretty, pretty developed encapsulation of that, because what it's effectively doing is like saying, it's the macro and the micro in the same place. And, you know, in a way that's really different than a song like, Another Bag of Bones, which is like one person who's certainly like focusing in on certain things, but that's very clearly like a global song. I think Brothers Blood is like something that ends up feeling a lot bigger than it is in some ways, because it's one person looking at the most local part of themselves and seeing the kind of global nature of that experience, if that makes sense. So,
but it starts like very like within the, like literally within the person, like your brother's blood, is like kind of the smallest level, and then expanding from there.
And his anger, and his like, you know, seeing, I have a 3.5 year old daughter, and I love my dad. My dad loved me and his kids a great deal, but my dad was a person who was a product of his environment, his upbringing, his time. And there was, I see his temper in me sometimes. And I'm like, whoa, holy shit. Like, I thought I was like the sort of most mild mannered of the divine people. And there's like certainly an anger in there. So I think that song was like reckoning with some of the decision-making that was happening in my personal life too. Like, what am I doing? And seeing like a line between like some of the messes I was making and was caught in, and some of the messes he had made, you know, that kind of stuff. But, that's as close as cause I also think that a lot of my songs, I can talk like that about them. Sometimes I can't talk like that about them for years, because I kind of see them more like I'm not a fine artist, I'm not a painter, but often I think if I were, some of the stuff, and even some of the stuff I'm writing right now, there's like stuff that you're like, I can feel it, and I can give you a general idea, but it's a little bit more Jackson Pollock, a little bit less like still life, you know? And it's later that I'm like, oh, that's a bowl of cherries or whatever. So I think that, and I like that. I remember, you know, this is a ridiculous example to cite, because I was a big fan of this band when I was a kid, and I have a lot of respect for them, but I'm not like a huge fan of their band today, but I remember being a kid and watching an interview with Pearl Jam. And I remember Eddie Vedder saying like, when being asked about the lyrics to one of the songs, it might've been Jeremy, you know, and him being like, oh, I want people to be able to interpret what they think the song's about. Like, I have my own interpretation of it, but, and I remember like in a less, I think in retrospect, they say as much in that Pearl Jam movie, I think all of them were just kind of like, what does Kurt Cobain say? And then they would say a version of that themselves. But he was big about that too. He was like, these lyrics are, he was intentionally cat and mouse too much about it, where he was like, oh, none of it means anything. And it was like, that's not true. You know, that's not true. But I do think sometimes, like, I don't like it when somebody tells me like, this is exactly what this song is about, because then what's the, and it is painterly, and it is, I think the best thing I could say about what I have made is that I think it occupies some space between like journalism and dreaming. Yeah. It's like what is and what if kind of sit next to each other. And if I lean too far into the what is, then you don't get to move around in the what if. So, and that can be like somebody else's job. I think that's cool when certain people are like, I wrote this song this way to mean this thing, and that's what it is. And that's fine. But I don't want to be like I don't know. I don't want to have like a dom sub relationship with my audience about like about what they think something can mean. You know, I think that's like weird.
You're like, no, this is not canon.
No, no, exactly. It's like fucking and plus to some extent, and then I'll shut up. To some extent, I firmly believe that a lot of artists affix meaning retrospectively, retroactively. I really believe a lot of people are like, they puke something and then they go like, oh, this means that. And I do too, but I'd rather like take my time getting to that, you know? So, cause you're really just writing from a feeling. And even when it's a story song.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my two cents.
Totally, because you can have like a, you can, you know, have something that's 90% like incredibly factual to events that happen in your life, maybe. And then like one line doesn't sound that great. And so you're like, all right, you know, I'm going to change that one line, and it changes kind of the whole meaning of the song. And you're like, oh, I'm okay with that. Like, that's fine. That's kind of like how I feel. Yeah.
Yep. And also there's a funny thing that like authenticity is a funny thing to whom, like, I don't know the authentic, I remember being in a college, cultural theory kind of music, like writing intellectually about music. It was a bunch of people jerking off essentially, but I do remember something that never left me as a lifelong top three, no matter, I think he would probably be the most insufferable person to be around, but fuck if I don't think Bob Dylan is like one of the few actual geniuses of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I think he's probably a terrible guy, but I think he's a genius, or he had the genius visit him for longer than most people do, put it that way. Mm-hmm. That being said, I remember somebody talking about like authenticity and Bob Dylan, and somebody being like, what? And a teacher who was Armenian woman, Anahit Kasabian, who was very good, being like, what makes Bob Dylan more authentic than Britney Spears? Hmm. And somebody being like, well, this, you know, all of the markers of authenticity, and being like, Bob Dylan, that's not his real name. He made up his entire origin story and then made it over and over again numerous times. Britney Spears is exactly who she says she is. She's like not especially intellectual pop star, literal product of Disney, perhaps one of the five most capitalistic American enterprises ever created. You know, like, doesn't hide it. But Bob Dylan records for all of the same recording companies. His music is in Victoria's Secret advertisements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's, you know, but he sang about social justice. And by the way, when that stopped being useful to him, he stopped doing that too.
Right.
So all of a sudden there's this argument that you're like, well, actually Bob Dylan is a genius, but a total construct. And Britney Spears is a construct who knows exactly, who's like never said she was anything but that. So to me, like when I get into like the authenticity, even with writing, that doesn't mean a goddamn thing, by the way, about who's the better artist. That's also subjective. And I think Bob Dylan in his way, it was a thought exercise more than anything else. But what I do think is like that stuff about like, am I telling the truth in this song? That's like a color or a feeling. That's not like, do I actually give them all of the correct biographical information or the sequence of events? And even in a song like I Was Alive Back Then, where I talk very plainly about people in my life or moments in my life, like there's still some amount of that that's like mixed with like inner dialogue, mixed with, which is the least fucking reliable thing you can ever go by, or mixed with like what, there's still some amount of like dreaming in with some of that. It's not literally like it's so I don't know. I don't think that's irresponsible. I think that's, to me, that is actually more a representation of what being a person is actually like. Cause I don't know that anybody actually thinks that. I can't say that. I do not think that linearly. I think, all over the place. And so I don't know, but I think that, I think that you know, that song Brothers Blood in specific is a place where like a lot of that stuff sits really nicely to, with one another and in a way that is like compelling. And so I understand that too.
Yeah. That's as someone, I think a lot about authenticity, and it's sort of in a, you know, grander existential sense. And that's really interesting. I'm glad you said that about that song in particular, because I find that really interesting.
Like, I kind of think thinking about authenticity is a good thing, because I think I don't need to suggest like nothing means, things mean a lot,
right?
And things matter. I just mean it more like, like,
yeah, there's no one A to Z way to think about this one song or one piece of art or even one story, because there are different perspectives on that story and different,
right,
all that stuff.
That's
yeah.
exactly right.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, you know, authenticity as manifested through like trying to the best of your ability to be an honest person, that's great. And that's like a life's pursuit. That's a vocation. That's hard enough to do. So, but hey, David, unfortunately, I have to jump, because I have to go get my daughter in a minute. But I appreciate you talking to me about this. I'm sorry. I hope I got to some of what you wanted to talk about.
Oh, absolutely. This was fantastic. Thank you so much for taking so much of your time. I really do appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure.
It moves, it's a disappear glacier, it's an airborne flu, it's your disbelieving eyes locking concrete miles, it's your yawning conscience and your lawyer's smile, it's an occupied country foaming at the mouth, no smoking gun, no mushroom cloud, it's a military mother with a boy in hell, and it's a flag draped casket down an oil well, it's an Argentine schoolgirl gagged and bound, it's a torture camp, it's a long way down, it's the constant bracing shock of now, and it's the whole damn world turned inside out, alright. Well, it's a march to extinction with your god in step. It's his name in your mouth, it's his cross on your neck. It's a farm boy sprinting over desert dirt, and he's patting the Our Father in staccato spurts. Now that's his automatic rifle, tells no lies. That's truth in your stomach is no alibi. But the trouble lies on the other side, with an equal truth prepping for this holy night. So you're dressing in the starlink in the virgin sky, and here's the call of milk and honey from the afterlife. And as it eases to the checkpoint, it's common shore. It's collateral damage, it's the cost of war. It's another bag of bones for the gods to sort. Just another bag of bones for the gods to sort. January heat wave in a pulsing crowd. It's an African militia, kids with submachines. It's a conflict diamond on your bride to be. It's the dispossessed lining up at every gate. It's the facts worth facing, facing way too late. It's the mission of modernity, go get what's yours. Till there's nothing left over to go get no more. And it's not what we're owed, but it's what we've earned. And it's closer than we realize, it's time now to burn.